Good morning. We are going to call this meeting of the Property Tax Relief and Local Sales Tax Division to order. And welcome, members. I think on the agenda it shows, of course, approval of minutes, which we can't do until we get a quorum here. And we'll also talk about the property tax comment line towards the end. And then there's also some other announcements and a schedule of upcoming bills and when they will be heard and so forth. So we'll do that towards the end. So this is the last day of hearing from various groups. And again, I need to say, did we include all groups? No, we did not. But I do think we've heard from a good sampling of the groups that have been impacted and have a stake and can provide good input on property tax relief. So today we are hearing from business groups, and again, I appreciate their patience. We didn't get to them last week, and they're back here today. Thank you for that. So if we can start with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And if you would introduce yourself, and welcome to the committee this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Minnesota Chamber has approximately 2,400 members throughout the state of Minnesota. 80% of those member businesses have less than 100 employees, and we represent businesses in every segment of the economy in Minnesota. And finally, we have over 130 chamber affiliates throughout the state. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you this morning about how business feels about property tax and property tax relief in Minnesota. We're here today to tell you that the Chamber supported the 2001 property tax relief measures, and there are three specific areas that we would like to see not changed. Specifically, we do not want to see any changes in the property tax classification system, nor any changes to the amount or structure of the statewide property tax. And finally, we would like to see that limited market value is phased out as scheduled. For a little more specifics in terms of the classification system, the Chamber opposes any changes that increase commercial industrial's property tax share or the share of the tax burden. Between 1996 and 2007, the effective tax rate for homestead property in Minnesota dropped from 1.7% down to 1.05%. So we contend that the reforms from 2001 are working. However, despite this reform, the effective tax rate for business still remains three times higher than that for residential homestead property. In terms of the statewide property tax, the Chamber opposes increasing the base level. We also oppose changing the structure of the tax from a fixed dollar amount to a fixed rate. And in 2007, this year, statewide property tax will bring in over $700 million, which means since 2002, when the statewide property tax started, the statewide property tax has grown from its initial $592 million a year to almost $700 million, an increase of almost $100 million over 5 years. Also, under current law, the statewide property tax already goes up every year. It's indexed to the rate of inflation, to the implicit price deflector for government purchases. And finally, regarding limited market value, the Chamber supports the phase-out of limited market value and would like to see it implemented as scheduled. The 2001 legislation began a six-year phase-out, and it's already been extended 2 years. The effect of limited market value is that it changes the distribution of who pays tax, and it shifts the property tax from to unprotected properties like commercial industrial. Not only is this bad for business, but it's a bad deal for homeowners. In 2005, the Department of Revenue came out with a study that said over 440,000 homeowners would pay $100 million more in tax. That's about 32% of the state, but over 68% of the state would pay approximately $95 million more in property tax, which means that the tax just got shifted to over two-thirds of the state. The Chamber believes that extending limited market value, again, would be contrary to the 2001 reforms, and we would like to see it phased out as scheduled because it protects both business and homes. So in conclusion, we would just like to say that business pays its fair share of taxes in the statewide property tax, and we have an effective tax rate that's three times that of residential homestead, and we would like to see the 2001 reforms stay as they currently are scheduled. So again, thank you for this opportunity, And, Mr. Chair, I would like to add that we did receive your communication a few weeks ago asking for business input regarding property taxes in this state, and we did send out that communication to all 2,400 of our members in an email yesterday.
Cool. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Dietrich? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Minnesota Business Partnership. Good morning,
Chairman. Thank you. I'm Jill Larson from the Minnesota Business Partnership. For those of you that don't know, the partnership is composed of about 112 chief executives of Minnesota's largest employers. Together, our members employ about 1.9 million people worldwide, including about 400,000 Minnesotans. Mr. Chairman, members, thanks very much for giving us some time today to talk about property taxes and business property taxes specifically. There's been a lot of discussion lately in this committee and in the entire legislature about property tax relief in general, and specifically about the 2001 reforms. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about those reforms because we think that those were good changes, and we would like to see those changes kept in place. The bipartisan property tax reforms that were passed in the late 90s and in 2001 were enacted to improve Minnesota's competitive business climate and to make the property tax system more accountable. Back in 1995, a property taxes on a commercial property valued at $1 million were the highest in the country. There was bipartisan agreement back then that needed to change, that ranking needed to come down in order to help make Minnesota more competitive. Also, as Mr. Hines mentioned in his presentation a couple of weeks ago, the reforms were also done to help make the system more accountable. That was done to help align the cost of public services more closely to the people who are actually getting those services, to the voters, meaning homeowners. And the reductions in the disparity between business property and homestead property made the tax system more visible and, frankly, we think more fair. As you know, business taxes are regressive. They're passed on to people, either passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices or on to employees in the form of lower wages and benefits or on to shareholders in the form of lower returns. Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to highlight a couple of points and reference a couple of documents that I think that you have in your packet. First, and Mr. Dietrichs mentioned this, but we believe that business property is paying more than its fair share. House staff has mentioned this in the past, but homesteads account for about 59% of the total statewide market value and shoulder a little less than 48% of the total tax burden, while commercial industrial property accounts for about 11.5% of the market value, but shoulders 30% of the total property tax burden. Again, Mr. Dietrichs mentioned this, but effective tax rates on homes have fallen from 1.7% in 97 to 1.05%. That's projected for 2007. That's a 38% reduction. Now, business property taxes, effective tax rates have also fallen, but they're still three times higher than homes. Second point I want to make is we believe that the recent property tax reforms have worked, both for businesses and for homes. One of the handouts in your packet is a table from a recent Minnesota Taxpayers Association study that compared property taxes across all 50 states. On table 11 that you have, you'll see that because of the reforms passed over the last several years, that number one ranking that I mentioned for the million-dollar commercial property in 1995 has now fallen to 14th. While at the same time, residential property taxes in Minnesota have also fallen in comparison to other states. Taxes on a $150,000 home in Minneapolis in 1995 they're now ranked 29th. And so they were 14th highest in the nation in 95, now they're 29th. A more probably relative example is a $300,000 home in Minneapolis, that is now ranked, I think, 28th in the country. Table 10 in your packet, also from the MTA study, shows Minnesota property tax burdens compared to five of our neighboring states. And although recent reforms have lowered our national ranking, you'll see that for most commercial property, Minnesota still ranks among the highest tax compared to our neighbors. Third point, and this has been talked about in this committee in the past, but property values impact property taxes. There's another handout in your packet that shows the annual growth in taxable market value for high-value business property and for homesteads over the last few years. And you will see this inverse line. Property values just basically tanked after the recession. At the same time, home values continue to go through the roof. And as a result, property taxes on homes went up faster than on businesses. As has been mentioned before, business values are going back up, home values are stabilizing, and that, we think, will shift more of the burden back onto businesses and off of homes. Last point I'd like to make, business property taxes are increasing as well as homesteads. We've heard lots of talk about homesteads increasing, but the last handout in your packet is a chart that we put together. It's compiled based on the latest House research property tax simulations. It shows proposed 2007 property tax increases for existing homesteads and for high-value CI properties. I picked out various locations across the state. And as you can see, in many cases, property taxes on high-value CI are set to increase as much as or actually more than homestead taxes. And in all cases, effective tax rates on commercial property are substantially higher than on homes. Finally, this is not to say that we don't think homesteads should receive relief from the legislature this year. We understand many homeowners are seeing increases that they find unacceptable. We understand the legislature wants to provide relief. We do not oppose those efforts. We just simply believe that that relief should be provided without undoing the 2001 reforms and without increasing business taxes to pay for that homestead relief. Those are my comments. I'd like to thank you again for your time and be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Larson? If not, thank you so much.
Thank you for turning the heat up. We appreciate it.
The Minnesota Realtors Association, next up. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Susan Diore, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and with me today is my colleague, Christine Berger. And I'm going to make a couple points and turn it over to her for a minute and then end with a few more. Just from a historical perspective, I thought it might be helpful for the committee to know that the Minnesota Association of Realtors has primarily worked on three goals in pertaining to property taxes. First would be class rate compression, or what we like to call a house is a house. The second one is the state assumption of K through 12 property tax levy, which we all saw in 2001. And finally, we prefer that property tax relief go directly to the taxpayers and not to local governments. And we continue on that. And to that last point, I'm going to ask Christine to talk to you real briefly about that.
Ms. Berger?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christine Berger, and I'm with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Last month, this division, along with the full tax committee, reviewed the goals of the 2001 property tax reform. Two of the goals included decreasing the state's role in financing municipal services to give residents more direct responsibility for municipal service decisions. And the second goal was to begin shifting state tax relief dollars to programs that consider a taxpayer's ability to pay. Therefore, realtors view the circuit breaker, or the property tax refund, as the best form of property tax relief and the program that best fits with the goals of the 2001 reform. The circuit breaker is determined by the relationship of property taxes or rent paid to household income. The circuit breaker, as it is calculated on one's ability to pay, directs money to those individuals who really need the relief. Many will point out that LGA tends to go towards cities that have lower income residents, but not all residents in the cities have low incomes and need the relief. The circuit breaker dollars are more effective because they are directed to where the relief is needed. In your packet distributed by the Minnesota Realtors is a graph on the importance of the circuit breaker. The graph shows property taxes as a percentage of market value and as property taxes as a percentage of personal income. The dotted line shows in recent years how the ratio of property taxes as a percentage of income has increased. This means that property taxes are increasing faster than personal income. The solid line shows that the ratio of property taxes as a percentage of market value has decreased. This is largely due to gains in market values. Thus, with property taxes increasing faster than personal income, realtors say switch to the circuit breaker. Now, Susan has a few concluding remarks for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have, and members, I just have three final points for your consideration. The first one, I gave you the historical perspective, we want to ask you to kind of look forward and not look forward this year or next, but to urge all of you to consider all of your tax and spending provisions in light of the mounting hurdles that the state of Minnesota is going to incur or face in the next 10 years here. We have significant changing demographics in the state. We are aging, that is going to result in less income taxes based on how Social Security is taxed, which is we handed out to you a little booklet that kind of puts forth our positions on these with all of our demographic data as well as the income data, et cetera. We know that if we try to relieve property taxes, we increase potentially and substitute that with income and sales tax from the general fund, that creates more of a burden on that income and sales tax in order to lower those property taxes. To rely on that income and sales tax to reduce the amount of property taxes does two negative things. It hides the true cost of local government spending, number one, and it increases the dependence on income and sales tax at a time when we are going to be facing a decrease in our income tax potentially. We also are facing the issue of declining enrollment. We don't have as many people following that baby boom generation. So for another 10, 15 years before, unless we get some significant immigration, we're going to have issues there as well. The second point we would urge the committee to consider is other tax proposals that are being considered that would affect property values, such as the D-tax. We know that it's been introduced in the Senate. We know that it's, we understand that it's going to be introduced here in the House. The proposal we have seen in the past is to increase the D-tax rate by 50%. That it would have a significant impact on properties as well, even more so than some of the property tax increases you have seen. The other consideration that's been already discussed earlier by other testifiers is the potential for increasing the statewide business property tax. As has already been mentioned, we do also believe that there is going to be a shift in values from residential to commercial. We think if not seeing a flattening out of values in residential, there might be some pockets of actual decline. Shifting that, we know that it's regressive and it's passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices and lower wages or lost jobs. Right now, just to give you a sense of the residential status, we have a significant supply of residential housing on the market. We have approximately one buyer for every seven houses in the metropolitan area. So we have about a 14-month supply of residential property right now. So we're definitely seeing a flattening out of residential buying and selling. We, again, have some concerns about foreclosures and high-risk mortgages that were out there, particularly in certain pockets of the state. Finally, Mr. Chair, the third and final point, you requested that I speak to the committee about the issue of other local governmental revenues in addition to levy and aids. Also in your packet, we provided you with a copy of a summary chart that the State Auditor's Office has put out about local government spending. You will see that in addition to the significant increases in property taxes as a total of local government income. There are a couple of other significant increases in revenues, one of which is building. During the building boom, they received many building impact fees. The concern we have about these fees, and there's also a very good example of one suburban city that showed you the impact fees that went on to one house on a one-acre lot. And you'll see on the back of that, we've listed out all of those impact fees, and we do believe it's underestimated because it did not include the actual building permit fees, but it tallied up to $51,000. $51,000 in impact fee is going to not only obviously raise the cost of that house, but it is also going to raise the values of existing property, not to mention the fact that we have included that in somebody's 30-year, 40-year mortgage, as well as their property tax considerations. So I know that this committee has a lot to consider, and we greatly appreciate the time to testify before you today.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Ms. Diori or Ms. Berger? Representative Woffler.
Mr. Chairman, and to our guests, I mean, I think there have been a variety of shifts, but but the shifts I hear more about are the ones that went from commercial industrial to the homeowners, and I think we have to kind of look at things a little historically. But the one thing I'd be really interested in, and you maybe it's our staff who would have more information, is the impact of this foreclosure boom that I'm told is really we're at the start of the wave. We're not at the end of the wave yet. What impact that's having on property tax collection rates? I mean, that has always been a very solid, reliable source of income and a steady revenue stream to local governments. And as we have more and more people who got in over their head, got bad products, maybe with or without the assistance of a realtor, they may have just selected a bad mortgage broker, I'm really concerned that this is something that's going to have implications for our property tax system and the partnership that we have with local governments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I don't have any specific data on that. I'm sure that there is a particular concern, mainly in the North Minneapolis area. We also think it's going to be St. Louis County. Significant foreclosure rates there just because of how we've seen the equity being tapped out. But I don't have any specific data on, other than I can tell you that there's going to be $2 trillion worth of ARMs coming due in the next couple of years. So we know that we're probably, as you mentioned, just on the cusp of more foreclosures. So to the degree that there's a collection of data there on foreclosures, I don't have any data on that specifically.
Representative Loeffler, follow up.
Chairman, just to follow up, that $2 trillion of ARMs in the next couple of years, is that Minnesota only?
That's nationally.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Blanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Diori, oftentimes the first complaint coming from people about property taxes has to do with their rapidly increasing values. And what is the position of the association with regard to assessment practices and making sure that the properties are being fairly assessed?
Ms. Diori?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning. We think that the current system works pretty well. I mean, the assessors usually use market data pretty quickly as long as it's been submitted and recorded in a timely manner. We've encouraged our realtor members, if they believe that there's some discrepancies, to certainly go and dispute that accordingly. If nothing else, we're probably going to see people disputing that more today than they have in the past. But actually, another big packet that we put together for you is a chart across the state of property values versus the percentage of property taxes, property tax increases that they've experienced. And we've historically have made the argument that for any other asset you have received, we're getting taxed, as we saw in this brief chart, also from the value increase, the property tax increase is pretty low. In other words, if you compared that to your income tax, if you got the same increase in your income tax, you'd be paying substantially more in taxes. So I guess from our perspective, we think it's relatively in good shape from the assessment perspective.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? If not, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate all the groups and all the input. As members, we have all sorts of information to go on as we start building a property tax relief bill. Before we move on, we have a quorum here, and we have some minutes of Friday, February 2nd, and I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes. And I see Representative Dietrich has moved to approve the February 2nd, 2007 minutes. Any discussion? If not, I'm going to call for a vote on those minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Also, for those who are a little more challenged on finding our handouts as we go on during the day, we've tried to color code many of these. So as the staff will make presentations today, we've got color codes and so forth. Hopefully that'll make things a little bit easier. I know in these committees you get all these papers, and it is tough to find those. So we're going to try to make that a little easier for everyone. Also, Ms. Schill has provided for all members a glossary of fiscal terms and so forth. And if you page 49, I think, is where all the tax items begin. But that's for future reference also. So with that, we'll move. Mr. Hines is going to make a presentation on market value homestead credit, and then Ms. Dalton will be talking about local sales taxes, and that would complete our overview from House Research staff. So, Mr. Hines, if you would proceed with market value homestead credit. And that's, we're going to be looking at something that is going to be in blue. Is that correct? That's the, so it should be.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. As you've said, the handout I'm going to be speaking from today is the blue one in your folders, and we also have it up on the screen, although the print may be too small to see it up there. But this was the one feature of the presentation that we didn't get to the last week, which was to talk about the market value homestead credit. And we thought that in the context of describing the market value homestead credit, it might be also useful to take a look at the governor's proposal. So this is kind of serving both purposes. The first column then of the handout represents the range of market values, and the second column, homestead count, in thousands. That is approximately the amount of homes there are in each of those income or of those household value ranges statewide. So the bottom there, it says state total. That's about 1.4 million homes, and actually this does not include ag homes. That adds about another 100,000. So it's about 1.5 million homesteads in the state. The next column is the midpoint of the market value range. And then the credit, the existing credit on the next column over, is the credit that goes with that midpoint value. That's why I put the midpoint in there. So it shows the pattern, as you can see, of the homestead credit is that the two low values there are it's increasing from 37,500 home is 150, the 62,000 home 250, 87,000. 294, it goes up by until you reach a maximum of $304 at $76,000 of market value. And then after that point to $76,000, then as the value goes up, you'll see that the credit goes down at a much slower rate. So, but it's a straight line decline through the whole range of values. This shows a $412,000 home at $1. Actually, 414 is a number you might hear about. That's where it actually goes to zero. So it declines about $90 per $100,000 of value is a good way to think about it or to look at it. The next column then shows a net tax, and this is just picking a fairly average statewide tax rate of about 115%. Of course, that would vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, so these are just for the average for that particular tax rate, but it's pretty illustrative of what's going on. So you can see what the net tax ends up being on the homes in each of those values, and the column next to that then is the effective tax rate, which we described a little bit in the previous orientation session, is the net tax divided by the value of the property. And you'll see that that measure is 0.75 at the low end of our range here, and it goes up to about 1.15%. So it steadily increases as you go up because of that declining homestead credit, market value homestead credit, that the effective tax rate just gets a little bit higher as you climb up the value scale. Now, the next column is shows the governor's proposal, which and I think the chairman would rather if I had a graph here to show you, but it shows that make one with my hand. Instead, right now the credit goes up till you reach the 76,000 point and then starts to go down. Under the governor's proposal, it still goes up at the same rate to 76,000 and a 304 max. Then it levels off $304 for all the way up to your 118,000 value, and then it starts the decline on the same slope that had been on before. So when you play that out as to what it amounts to a $38 tax increase across most of the credit increase. Did I say tax? Sorry, credit. Across most of the value range here. So at the very low end, you see no change because they're still on the part where the value is going up. Then in that first sort of transitional range, the home value of $87,000, you see about a $10 increase. It was close to the maximum already. And then the next one is not quite the 38, but then you see from the $138,000 home all the way to the $425,000 home, just a straight $38 reduction in tax from the governor's proposal. The one near the bottom there, the $437,000 home is only $16, and because they're in the new phase-out range, zero at the 462. Then just following it out, then the proposed net tax, just to show what that added credit would do for the tax, change in tax in a percentage terms. So you can see that in percentage terms, the maximum that added the governor's proposed increase in the credit would be is about 3.2% at a value of, 112,000. And it drops off from there to where you're down below 1% above about a value of about 330,000. So it's a fairly modest change in the tax burden once you get up the value scale very far. And the effective tax rate under the proposal shows in that second to the right-hand column. Again, it's still the same range of 75 to 1.15, but most of the homes in the middle of the range do show a very slight drop in their effective tax rate. And finally, that last column then is sort of going off the fact that we know approximately the count of homes in each of those value ranges to show where the total cost of the program is in terms of the value range. So what that's showing is, for instance, you see that the biggest range of affected taxes is it, or affected values is the $150,000 to $175,000 range. That's about $6.3 million of the cost goes there. $175,000 to $200,000, about the same almost number value of the cost is in that income, is in that valuation range, etc. The number that shows at the bottom of this is about $41.5 million. That's a little short of the estimate. Again, the ag homesteads are not included in this, which is part of that. And I think that the data source on these value homes might be a little different between what the Department of Revenue is using now and what I had available, but it's pretty close. And with that, I think I'll stop for questions.
Okay, very good. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hines, is it possible or do we have the same kind of breakdown on a regional basis, where you take different regions in the state and have essentially the same analysis? The reason for my question, obviously, is that for a lot of folks in greater Minnesota, you don't get up over 200,000 very much. And do we have that capability?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, we do have that capability, yes, to show this. Now, of course, a lot of these columns wouldn't be different by where you were in the state. The amount of the credit per value of home is the same anywhere in the state. But it would be in terms of showing where a typical sort of value ranges would be, the count in each value range, that would vary obviously from place to place. What might be an appropriate tax rate to pick might vary. But yes, we do have all that information. But the point about the governor's, the credit amount and the governor's proposed change by value of property would not vary in the state. But where the cost is going, et cetera, that would.
Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that. In terms of state costs, I'd like to see how much of the cost is associated with regions in greater Minnesota versus the metro area, so that we have a clear picture of where this support is going to be distributed.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, we can do that, and we will do that.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Hines. I'm still absorbing a lot, and you guys do a really good job of, but I can't retain it from meeting to meeting as much as I'd like to. So could you just review again the egg homestead situation and why you wouldn't include those in this table or why they're treated differently? I can't remember.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, that's a good question. The egg homesteads, to review that, they receive the market value homestead credit on their house, garage, and 1 acre, the same as the house would be in town. The reason they're not included in this table is that the data set that I have, a data set available of all the homes in the state that does not include the ag homesteads for reasons that are, it just is a quirk of the data that I have available. So again, with an ag homestead, the house, garage, and 1 acre value, the amount of credit they receive now and under the proposal would be the same whether they were there or not. It's just that you're not seeing the full state cost and you're not seeing the full count of homes because those aren't being included.
Thank you.
And Mr. Hines and members, and one thing unique about this program is that the cost of it each year is actually going down as people drop off and home values go up. So ultimately, if it came to a conclusion, you'd actually go down to zero cost of this unless we would end up moving things. But Mr. Hines, a little bit of a history on market value. I remember when I was first homeowner, we had a system where you get up to like $700 max. It was like 54%, and then it switched to it went to an educational homestead credit, and actually towards the end, up to 2001, that was like up to about 83% of your education levy was your homestead credit. And that's why in 2001, when education was taken off of the property taxes, seasonal rec would have received a huge benefit versus actually a homeowner, because 83% of your school bill you weren't seeing because of the homestead credit. And so at that time, not only did the homestead credit get put on residential, but then the statewide tax and some other things. Otherwise, if I remember initially, I think seasonal rec would have seen about a 20% decrease without anything else. But would you care to talk a little bit about the philosophy and why do we have the system we have today?
Mr. Chairman, your recollection's quite accurate. Up and through from the early 70s until, or maybe even the late 60s, up until 1989, we had a credit that, as you recalled, what paid about 54%. I think it might have actually been 58% in the last year or one of the years in there, but in the 50 or low 50% of a homeowner's tax, up to a maximum dollar amount, which was in that $700 range, I think, by the end of that period. And then in 88 and 89, we made some pretty major changes in the system, and we basically got rid of the homestead credit completely in favor in favor of doing all the homestead relief through the class rate system rather than through a combination of the class rates and the credits. And at the same time, we created a new aid program that was called HACA. It had the homestead credit and agricultural aid, partly to make people realize that that missing dollars from the homestead credit was sort of still in the system, except now it had become an aid payable up front to the local governments rather than as a credit on the taxpayer statement for about from 89 through the, I think, 97 approximately. We had no homestead credit at all. And then starting in 97 or 8, we instituted, as you recollected, the education homestead credit, which paid for an increasingly higher percentage of the general ed levy that would have fallen on a home. And so it got stepped up to 83% in 2001 before this last reform. And again, in that case, that proposal or the credit was created, the education homestead credit, partly to offset the cost of shifting some of the class rates on the higher classes of property, commercial, industrial, apartments, and even the upper value of homes down, and the education homestead credit was a way to relieve the burden on homes that you were shifting on from these others. So that was kind of why that one was in place. And then 2001, you're correct in that the homeowners didn't see nearly as much relief from the takeover of the general ed levy as the other classes of property because of this feature that they hadn't been paying most of it anyway at the end. And so that's some of the reasons why, for instance, why the seasonal rec property did get the seasonal rec, or the state tax was put on them to so that they wouldn't have this big reduction in their tax burden from the general ed takeover.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Hines, the market value homestead credit? Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, other things we've presented too, this might be a day to ask them if questions had come up previously. Ms. Dalton and I will both be up here, so maybe after hers we could, if anybody remembers other questions, we'd be happy to.
Sounds good. And as Ms. Dalton takes the chair there, one thing we plan to do as we handle bills, and we're going to be doing those in topics, and I have a schedule I'm going to pass out towards the end of the meeting. We'll probably spend the first 5 minutes of that meeting kind of just quickly reviewing kind of those subjects that we're going to be looking at so we can keep things all in proper perspective. Ms. Dalton, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You'll be happy to know this is the last topic we're going to be providing an overview for, and then you will be done with us for a while.
You're happy.
We're happy to. I'm going to be talking off of the TAN package, and the TAN package has two things in it. The top thing is actually a memo that has gone out to the tax committee in previous years. It's been updated slightly, but it's essentially a memo some of you will be familiar with. And then the second thing that's attached to it is an information brief that our office does on local sales taxes.
Representative Mullery,
is there supposed to be two sheets? Or?
I have page 3 and 4, and he has 5 and 6, so I think they're...
What we were trying to do is have members work more together. So we were trying to give you only half of it. How many do not have a full set there? Could members, I have one I can share up here, so... We'll send that this way. And how are we doing? I think Representative Lincheski still needs a full copy. We'll make sure Madam Chair gets one. Anybody else? Okay. We thought we were doing such a great job by color coding, but we'll just give you half the information. But we'll find it. It just won't all be there. Anyone else? All right. So thank you, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, although this would not be normally the order I do it this in, I will actually do it in the order that they're kind of stapled together. So I'm going to talk about the relationship between local sales taxes and state aids first. Very briefly, local sales taxes were forbidden in 1972 as part of the reforms of the Minnesota Miracle. And if you actually look for the statutory prohibition against local sales and income taxes, they aren't in either the income tax or the sales tax statutes. They are in the chapter with local government aids. It was part of, it was actually a subdivision of the local government aid program. It was the last subdivision in the local government aid program in 1972. It was an explicit trade-off. Local governments were given local government aid, but they were forbidden from imposing income taxes and sales taxes. So that's actually one of the things that this memo talks about, is that currently 20 states have general authority for cities to impose a local sales tax, and another 4 states allow certain types of cities to impose a local sales tax. But generally, if a state allows a local sales tax, they tend not to give local, general purpose local government aid. States tend to fall into one of two categories. Either states try to equalize resources available to local governments to provide necessary services, and that's kind of the philosophy that Minnesota has followed since 1972, or they tend to grant local governments maximum revenue flexibility by allowing them lots of autonomy in what types of revenues it raises, but they make little effort to ensure resource equity. And what I want to point out on that memo is, if you go to the back of the memo, there is actually a table that shows the 8 states that provide more, $100 or more per capita in LGA, and Minnesota is one of those. Only one of those states has a general authority for local sales taxes. And of the states that do not provide very much aid at all, many of them have local sales tax authority. So that's just the point that that memo is trying to make, that there is really a trade-off that you need to be thinking about in terms of policy. And if you think about it, it makes some sense. The cities who tend to have a high tax base also tend to be cities who have a high retail sales base. And if you allow them both a property tax and a sales tax, you're going to have much more much greater disparities in their ability to raise revenues. When I was making this presentation to the local government committee, I pointed out that if you allowed Bloomington to have a local half-cent sales tax, pretty much Bloomington could quit property taxes entirely. So, I mean, that's just, you know, the trade-off that exists. So, having said that, we will...
Representative Lanchesca, we will not entertain that bill before the committee.
So a brief history of local sales taxes in Minnesota. As I said, they were forbidden in 1972, and prior to 1980, only one city was allowed one, and that was the city of Duluth. And the thing I'd like to point out on the information brief is that there are some really handy tables in the back, and they list all the cities that have ever been granted local sales tax authority. The first table shows the ones that have actually imposed it or currently impose it. The second table shows ones that have imposed it and the tax expired. The third table shows the local taxes that were authorized but were never imposed and gives kind of what happened. And then the fourth table is the local sales tax authorized but not yet imposed, and that is the city of Worthington. So as I said, Duluth was the only one with a local sales tax prior to 1980. In 1991 and 1992, special authority was granted to 6 cities, but only 3 actually enacted their sales tax, and that would be Mankato, Cook, and St. Paul. Minneapolis actually enacted theirs in 1986. 1996 saw the statutory codification of requirements for imposing
local sales taxes, including the requirement that there be a referendum. Prior to that, every local sales tax was written as a special tax, and they weren't really very consistent. And there was a sales tax advisory commission that was a legislative advisory commission that was meeting. And one of their recommendations was that we codify kind of the standards for local sales taxes so they would be easier to administer and so people knew what kind of hoops they had to jump through when they wanted to impose them and how they would be imposed. In 1998 and 1999,
Just a second, Ms. Dalton. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, you mentioned the St. Paul one, and I'm not quite sure what this means. 40%, if you look at the one, does it mean that 40% goes to hockey arena and other neighborhood projects? Or does it mean 40% goes to the hockey arena and then the remainder for neighborhood projects and then it allowed uses of the remaining 6% modified over time? What does that mean? I thought at one point they had arts included in theirs.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, this is written badly. This 60% is for the neighborhood projects and arts and cultural things, and they've been allowed some operating. Theirs has been modified over time, and if you'd like to actually see the whole list of how that's changed, that's actually on our website. It's hard to get everything into one table, but we do actually, on our website, under local sales taxes, you can actually click on it, and it has a much greater detail about the authority of and what the allowed uses are for each local sales tax.
So this isn't
Representative Mulder?
The 60% is for the neighborhoods and the cultural things.
Okay.
As I said, 1998-1999, that was kind of the boom years for granting authority for local sales tax. 14 cities were granted local sales tax authority in the two-year period. What was really interesting about that two-year period, though, is only three of them were actually enacted. A lot of them on table two, on table three, those are the ones that were, a lot of those are the ones that were enacted, that were passed in that 98-99 period. And some of them actually had the referendum, and a number of them were defeated. The referendum was defeated, and the tax was not imposed. In 2000, and that actually kind of laid to rest some of the impetus for having local sales taxes for a while, but of course it came back full bore in 2003 and 2004. That really saw the start of the movement to enact general local sales tax authority, generally limited to just cities in outstate Minnesota. There was a provision that actually made it into the House Omnibus Tax Bill to allow a general local sales tax authority in larger cities in outstate Minnesota. It made it into the 2005 House Tax Bill but did not survive conference committee. And 2005 and 2006 saw a plethora of, and I love that word because it really describes this, plethora of new local sales taxes authorized or extended for existing authorities. These are the local sales taxes that were imposed prior to 2005. And you see it's a fairly small number. The other thing that's very interesting is two of those sales taxes were actually imposed and expired. They actually used it for the projects that they said they were going to use it for and let them expire.
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, I'm looking at them, and most of them seem to conform to the idea that I thought we had, that they go to regional centers, except for, Garrison and Baxter. I'm not quite sure how they fit in. But then Hermantown and Proctor are suburbs, and since we're excluding the suburbs here, how did that, other than maybe a certain member here that's is there another reason that the suburbs got it and they can't get it in the metro area?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, that is true that no suburb in the seven-county metropolitan area has been authorized to impose a local sales tax. I don't know that I can actually tell you why Hermantown or Proctor were allowed theirs. That was clearly the decision of the legislature. Yes, I think you could make the argument that they are suburbs of Duluth. One of the arguments that they made was that there was this tax in Duluth, and therefore they wanted to have the tax as well. So there wasn't a, you know, they figured they could do it without any disadvantage to their retail. But I would not, you know, comment on why they were allowed it.
To this point, I know Representative Lanning, but to this point, Representative Lincheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to toss in with Representative Mullery's question, my recollection is Hermantown and Proctor had a lot to do with a very persistent legislator who did a very good job for her community. But I do want to frame the suburban issue, just to remind people that there are 43 suburbs who have a local option sales tax in the seven-county metro. And while it was granted to Hennepin, the effect for those 43 communities is that they have a local option sales tax and did not get a referendum vote on it. So I think we have now crossed that line. It is forever gone. So with the Hennepin local option sales tax, it's being imposed not by the municipalities, but by the 43 suburban communities are against their wishes carrying that. So I think it's helpful for members to rethink how people used to think about these things, and I think once that passed, that means all bets are off. All suburbs are comers now. So,
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, is it clear in the law that if they're granted the authority and their referendum fails, that it is in fact dead, that they would have to come back for reauthorization, or is it possible that they could have a second or third referendum and still proceed with the original authorization?
Ms. Felt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way the ones have been written in recent memory is that they have to have there's a drop-dead date on when they have to have their election by. We did actually have one that didn't have a drop-dead date, and that was the city of Garrison, which is
table
which was
three.
In 1993, and as you notice on that, I say the referendum was never held. However, this authority has not expired. Now, it is not likely that they are going to be building a city sewer system. If they didn't build it back in 1993, they aren't likely to be coming back in and looking at this now. But they do actually have this authority still in law. And so to avoid that in the future, they've all now been written so they have to hold it at the next general election or at a general or local or a special election by a certain date. And so that, although that's not required in the statutes, that is the way they've all been written in the last
Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But I want to be clear. I noticed the Garrison exception, but for all the others where it has been defeated, they would have to get reauthorization?
Ms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Dalton, it doesn't feel to me, just looking at the list, that there's any kind of consistent rationale, that these just kind of got dealt with one by one, and it wasn't like a regional center gets to have a sales tax to deal with the extra burdens of being a regional center and public safety or other things. It looks like a lot of them are capital improvements, some of which you could maybe say impact their broader than their city limits, and some of which don't. I mean, am I kind of correct to get in a feel that there's like not a rationale that you could pull through all of these?
This is a great time, Ms. Dalton, to talk about what is required by the tax committee and what's required by statute.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just
Representative Mullery.
to point out what Ms. Dalton was just asked was, is the legislature rational?
Representative Mulery, she will not be forced to answer that question. Ms. Dalton, I see you have it up on the board there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, you are to some extent correct. There are some statutory requirements that are in law for local sales taxes. And then there are some, you know, guidelines, kind of like the Pirates Code, they're more like guidelines, that the tax committee has tried to follow, although they have not always followed them successfully. The other issue is that it's not just the House that is making the determination, but often a number of these local sales taxes were not authorized in the House omnibus bill, but came in through the Senate omnibus tax bill, and they may be imposing different standards. They often did impose, you know, different standards. I think the House has been a little bit more consistent about, you know, at least trying to find, you know, trying to determine that projects have some regional significance before they've allowed them. It's not always successfully, but I think that they certainly have. As I said, the law does not say suburbs are not allowed to impose the tax. That is not one of the statutory provisions. However, the House Tax Committee has taken the past, you know, stand that they did not want suburbs to be imposing it because of the fact that it would lead to some real inequities in revenue-raising ability. So the requirements are, statutory requirements are voter approval before imposing tax. It has to be for a bricks and mortar project only, which has to be specifically specified prior to the referendum. They have to put a dollar limit. That when they come forward to the legislature actually looking for this authority, they actually have to say how long the tax will be imposed and how long and how much money they plan on raising. And those tend to be written right into the special law. And so there is, generally speaking, an expiration date on the tax. Now, all three of those have been violated at some time. Now, most recently, voter approval before imposing the tax. That was clearly not required for the Hennepin County tax that was recently enacted. Bricks and mortar projects only. Duluth may use theirs for general. It goes into their general fund, and they may use it for whatever they want. St. Paul is allowed to use a portion of their sales tax for a number of different projects, and most recently they've been allowed to use a portion of that for actual operating costs of some of their programs. The other one that has violated that one is, I believe it's, I want to say it's the city of Mankato. Yes, it's the city of Mankato, which was just, its original authority had said it could spend up to $1.5 million on a sports arena, but the original law had been written in a way that said it could be spent for both the capital and for operating, but there was some question about whether the 1.5 was just, and, but once you spend that much money, you're done. And so now they're being allowed to spend some money for their operating up until a certain point, provided it was passed by, it was authorized by their voters, and it was. So there have been some exceptions to that. The expiration date, all of them have an expiration date except for the city of Duluth. Duluth has, you know, Duluth is always the exception to everything. However, some of those expiration dates are a little looser than other expiration dates. City of Minneapolis, because theirs is to fund construction and maintenance of the convention center, theirs expires when all bonds are paid off, but there's nothing that stops them from reissuing new bonds to essentially refurbish the convention center, because it's not just construction. It is
maintenance of the convention center. So,
Representative Mullery.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we always used to read about the Duluth ski weekend for legislators and their families. Was that what caused this exception? Or
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I do think it's just the fact that Duluth was the very first one, and nobody had really thought through, you know, some of the issues of granting these. I mean, theirs was granted back in 1973. I do believe that initially they were using it to fund Spirit Mountain and, I believe, their convention center. But, as I said, the way it was written, it goes into their general fund, and they may use it for whatever they want.
Yep. Representative Paymar.
Maybe I can clarify a couple of things with two cities here. This will age me, of course, but I'll just speak a little bit to the Duluth sales tax as well as the St. Paul sales tax. And I just want to make this point that it really shows the how the sales tax has been used to really buttress communities who are impacted by the economy. In 1973 in Duluth, this was the time that the steel plant closed and the mining industry tanked, and the city of Duluth was faced with desperate times, and in order to build their tourism base, they enacted this tax. As a former member of the Duluth City Council, I'm aware of the and now as a representative from St. Paul, I can speak to you about the just clarifying Representative Mullery's.
Now we know the common thread between these.
Never been opposed to a tax. As long as it's not used for good purposes. Unfortunately, the 60% that's used in St. Paul for what we call the STAR program that was supposed to be used for the cultural corridor in St. Paul, because of the cutbacks in LGA, the city of St. Paul has been forced to use some of that money for operating expenses. But this shows you the impact of to cities when the state really doesn't act, as in my mind, as a partner to help depressed areas and communities that are having a difficult time. I think we're going to see more of this, quite frankly. But anyway, that's the little historical.
Okay. Ms. Dalton, anything more on local sales tax?
Well, just we talked about this a little bit. There are some policy reasons for allowing local sales taxes. And the reasons generally given in favor of allowing a general authority is that it allows revenue diversification for local governments. It spreads the cost of regional projects to more users instead of just the local taxpayers. And it can offset some of the state aid loss in recent years. So, and I believe they've actually all been touched on in this discussion. To think about about why granting general authority has some problems. The biggest one is it increases the disparity between local government's ability to raise revenue. And it makes equalization through a state aid program harder to both measure and to achieve. And finally, it distorts the market as it relates to business location decisions. City of Rochester has a local sales tax. City of Rochester also tends to be involved in about one half of the annexations that occur in this state on an annual basis. They're very protective of, not only making sure that, it's not limited to just the retail development, but they're very protective of making sure their development, any development that occurs retail and residential, stays within their city limits. And I will end there.
Any questions? Not only this sales tax, but anything else that's been covered the last few weeks on the overview? If not, thank you so much for the presentation. And we've got a couple things to do here before we end. Mr. Cummings has put together kind of a recap of the property tax comment line. If pages would pass this out, and this is for your review.
Also, members, make sure you know that if you want to look at these, room 597, you can take a look through there. I think there's a total of 392 comments right now. About 280 through the email line and the remainder through emails, other emails and phone calls. So this has taken some quotes directly from those comments. Some are paraphrases, but I think you'll get a little flavor of that which is coming in. So feel free to take a look at that. Then, if I could have a page come forward. Members, spring training is over. We are now heading into the regular season. We'll announce our starting pitchers here soon. But we're now going to start hearing bills and putting things together on property tax relief. And what is going around right now is a tentative schedule, and that is underlined, of meeting dates and then also the main topics that are going to be covered. And, you know, there's a lot of different parts to the property tax relief package, and this is taking some of those major areas. And so what we're going to try to do is to take those bills and hear them under the topics.
Thank you.
And other bills that don't follow those topics will be heard on those dates following after we hear those various topic areas. So you can see just local sales taxes. We're going to look at that March 2nd. Do all those bills. And then also you'll notice Tuesday, March 13th, there's going to be a joint K-12 education finance, and this will be in the evening. I don't know what time. Remember, Chair Lincheski, when that would start? But it will be in the evening on a Tuesday, March 13th. So that, I don't think that will be state tournament time. I think that's Thursday and Friday, so I don't think you'll have to work.
Celebrating should be done by then, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And so, and the property tax relief, and what we'll do that night is hear all of the school levy, because that's really where the two committees come together. And so, as you can see, like Representative Demmer, if you see on March 2nd, we're dealing with agricultural issues, which I know you've been working on. Those would not include the school levy ones, but other things that you might have. So take a look at that. Like I said, this isn't set in stone, but it does give some guidance. And also, Chair Lincheski has said again that she would be willing, if we really run into problems on a Tuesday or Wednesday, to use some tax committee time, but we'll see. But anyway, any questions or comments? Anything we need to do? If you want things saved, keep it in your saved files. Otherwise, take everything out of there. Okay, I think we're good. All right, the members have a great weekend, and we are adjourned.